This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.starktruthradio.com.
This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Ashley Messinger. Ashley, great having you back on the show.
Thanks for having me again.
Ashley, you have a number of recent articles. Let's start off with the one about education, educating formality and its abundance. So this is a critique of our education system and also offers solutions.
Yeah, well, I guess the basic premise of that post is that education is in some ways doing too much. I mean, the education system as it's currently set up is, the theory is, there's a lot of research being done on this by Brian Kaplan, Robin Hanson, some interesting people, others, that it's more about signaling than it is about learning. There's this guy, this professor called Robin Hanson. He's an interesting chap, worth looking up. He recounts this story from a time when he attended university without registering for any of the courses. He ultimately ended up receiving a recommendation for it, but the point of that whole exercise and the reason he always brings it up is you can receive the greatest education the world has to offer, in theory anyway, for free, for no money at all, if you don't care about the credential. And if you, the suggestion being that it's more about credentialism than knowledge or learning. So
the ultimate goal of education should be to advance a civilization, not just about jobs and the economy, which is important, but also advancing civilization culturally. So there's a number of functions of modern education. There's the job market signaling, which that leads to the phenomenon of credential inflation. And then there's also the whole issue of basically babysitting.
Yes, well, certainly early education has a lot to do with that. I linked in that article to this story in the New York Times about mothers being penalized for making, you know, some fairly innocuous decisions, one would think, with respect to the upkeep of their, well, to raising their children, people calling it neglect and so on, which maybe in another time and place would have been considered totally normal, I'm not sure. But yeah, and that's why you have the free-range parenting movement, which I think you mentioned, and things like that.
Oh yeah, that's, that's gotten some mainstream media coverage, because there's been this phenomenon of helicopter parenting, and this started with the boomers, basically when my generation were kids back in the 90s, but it's probably much worse now. And this affects education, but I also think it leads to a lot more social isolation and a lack of social cohesion, too.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And then there's the whole issue of age segregation, which also contributes to lack of social cohesion.
Right, well, I think in the past, certainly within European history, children would work, especially within family business and other activities like that, but there's a taboo against it which started to emerge in the 20th century for somewhat understandable reasons. Of course, children are easier to exploit than adults and were often exploited during the Victorian period to do for what we would now consider to be very high risk jobs for, you know, vulnerable people like that. But I think increased automation somewhat mollifies that risk, in that many of those dangerous jobs will at some point be automated. And it's curious to think that the one exception we have to this whole moral taboo or this moral framework, it would seem anyway, seems more just a convenience than anything else for people's dull entertainment, would be something like child acting, despite the fact that it also carries certain risks, psychological risks, more than doing something very physically intensive, for example, because if you become famous as a child and then decide that you don't like it, it's too bad because the damage is already done. And in theory, I don't see any reason why you couldn't have even small children, teenagers, certainly working in some capacity, as long as there were regulations in place to prevent abuses. And there's also the whole issue of pedophilia hysteria that we've talked about before, causing more general age segregation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's probably one of the key factors in age segregation, with the issue of child labor laws. So, yeah, I mean, there were definitely valid reasons, because there was a lot of exploitation. So, prior to the Industrial Revolution, there was children and teenagers working on... I mean, the whole concept of adolescence, actually, I mean, that's a more modern phenomenon that developed in the 20th century. But basically, children were working on farms and apprentices for family businesses. Then, basically, when the Industrial Revolution happened, children working in factories, and there was the issue of exploitation. So in today's day and age, I think with the proletariat, there's two problems with the child labor and the proletariat. There's one issue is there's the issue of exploitation. If you have children from the proletariat doing jobs for lower wages, it's exploitation. But then it also creates incentives to grow the size of the proletariat, which is also a disruptive. But in the future, automation, as you said, will address a lot of those issues. So for more skilled jobs, say things in white-collar profession, technology, or just kind of families that own small to medium-sized businesses, and possibly even, obviously, a medical profession. I mean, that's too much high risk, but maybe like an intern at like a law firm, and like high-skilled jobs. It would have two effects. So one effect is it would have a kind of a positive natalist effect, where you see this population sink among the more well-educated segments of the population, but it would also create more productive values. So teenagers would learn skills that would help them as adults, but they would also learn, it would create better values than the current existing education. So there are more positive benefits for, say, a middle to upper income people, but the issues of exploitation are primarily a problem when you have like a large proletariat.
Right. And on age segregation, linking it back to the education system in general, I think I would say, and I made this point in that post you referenced, that there's too much segregation by age and not enough segregation just by raw ability with respect to children's education. For instance, I don't see any particular reason why child prodigies of, say, 5 or 6 years old shouldn't be allowed to attend a university, say, whatever you think about the particular utility of university, which is something else we could talk about. But if they're able to make the cut intellectually, again, as long as they're carefully supervised, and I linked to a couple of examples of prodigies like that in the article.
Yeah, because with age segregation, there is this effort to segregate adolescents from adults. But then basically what happens is, I mean, there are positive aspects where you can learn. There's a lot to learn from adults, and it has a number of effects. So it eliminates the role of sort of a mentorship. It creates more disruptive social hierarchies within adolescence. And then the other effect is it just an overall breakdown in social cohesion.
Indeed. With respect to social cohesion as well, I'm somewhat on board with the kind of NRX argument about localism, that nation-states as we conceive of them today are a fairly modern phenomenon. I've mentioned this on a previous podcast, and part of the reason they exist as they do now is because of the need that there was for inter-regional coordination when industry started to expand during the Industrial Revolution. It just wasn't practical to have tiny micro-states just doing their own thing. There needed to be coordination. And also because of the need to produce armies later on in the 19th and 20th centuries. But before all that, people still had identities, cohesive identities, ethnic, cultural, linguistic, etc. But people's identities were defined not very much at all by the political entities, the countries they inhabited in the way they are now. They were more local than that, more particular than that, you could say. And in a post-industrial world such as the one we live in, I think, you know, with far less war and so on, it's arguable that the nation-state isn't even the best way or the ideal way to create cohesion anymore, and that a regional or city-state model is probably better. And a plurality of micro-states like that also gives you more room to experiment with different types of policies, seeing what works and what doesn't. I've heard some people talk about this idea of government as a randomized control trial, where you basically have a patchwork of micro-states all doing different things, and you can kind of hash out in that way which policies are good and which aren't.
Yeah, so there is a lack of social cohesion on a nation-state, but just on a local level, there is a breakdown in social cohesion. So I do think that demographic changes in Europe and the United States contribute a lot to that, but you could still have an area that is a fairly homogenous. There's plenty of suburban areas in America that are still about like 80% white, and there's still these same problems where there's a lack of a social cohesion. So there's different factors. So demographics is one. People spending more time indoors on TV and online, and I think a lot of productive stuff can happen online, so I'm not against that, but as long as there's a balance. But that definitely is one issue. I think the urban planning model of the suburban single family home is a factor. And then the other factor is age segregation is huge, because historically communities encompassed people of all ages, and age segregation creates a massive breakdown. I mean, not just with the whole issue, even as I would say, the same applies almost to like college. College ties in with that, so people, even with younger adults, they socialize mostly with people their own age. So I guess people do connect more to people their own age, but someone could have a common interest with someone of any age. So that's a pretty recent phenomenon that wasn't the case throughout history.
Right. And there's also a concern, which I think you've mentioned before, about the certain aspects of the technifying or the digitizing of the world and of socializing, for instance, leads to more isolation. People spending more time indoors, etc. Yeah.
I do think sort of sexual hysterias play a big role. You said in your article that kidnapping and sex crimes are fairly rare, but I do know in the UK, it is actually a problem in the UK, but it's primarily with Pakistani Muslim grooming gangs. But I do get the impression that the whole pedophile hysteria is the primarily result of that. Hasn't been so much to like, it has had no effect whatsoever on cracking down on these Muslim grooming gangs, but it's actually done the opposite. It's led to a further breakdown in a social trust among white communities.
Yeah. Well, in that case, it's sort of one aspect of moral signaling combating against another. The moral signaling about pedophilia hysteria and the sort of the moral qualms people have about quote-unquote racism, however it's defined, yeah, which has led to this situation.
Yeah, it's really fascinating because there are these two hyper-moralistic ideologies that have taken over the West, and in a lot of cases they're actually in conflict with each other, so the society as a whole and the establishment outlets such as the media and education have been trying to find this bizarre balance, and that balance has led to what it does is more police state policies, but not productive police crackdowns on these actual grooming gangs, but more of a more destructive police state that breaks down cohesion and lower levels of social trust. So yeah, I mean, age segregation is like a sign of extreme social atomization. There's a whole issue where teens spend most of their time indoors, and so a big part of that is the internet and lack of social trust and helicopter parents. So we were talking about that free range children movement, and it's sort of it is a reaction to that. Part of the problem is because society is low trust, but there's also, there's concerns about crime. So basically you do have to require a high trust society. So one of the themes that Brandon and I have discussed on this show is this concept of a self-contained city. And a self-contained city is, it's an urbanist concept, but it's relevant to political sociological ideas because it's more of a new future oriented idea, but it would also bring back a lot of the positive aspects that traditionalists yearned for from the past, so it would create a much healthier high trust society.
Yeah, I would largely agree, especially if there was productive filtering of some kind for values or just general political tendencies or whatever takes your fancy, basically. I mean, I know out and out white nationalists would want an explicitly racialist state, which I'd be fine with, but you could organize, you know, I'd be quite happy with people separating on whatever basis they want, pretty much.
You need social cohesion, so if some people want to base it on an ethnic identity, that's fine, but I think social cohesion within an ethnically diverse population, it can work, but only under the situation where people have some kind of a shared values or interest. So what leads to a lack of social cohesion is where people feel that these other people have nothing in common, no shared values. So you need a shared values to bring people together. So obviously, ethnically homogenous communities are more high trust, but you can have people of different backgrounds if they have a shared interest or values.
Yes, I would agree.
So there's the idea of early education as babysitting, because that would actually not be necessary if you had a self-contained city. Because I remember, I mean, a lot of the time I spent in school, not just early education, even in high school, a lot of it was basically, it basically is glorified babysitting, because a lot of time is wasted, and it's kind of set up because parents have to work and they need a place to send their kids. So anymore in a kind of a self-contained city environment, education would be focused primarily on education itself and actually learning skills, but there wouldn't be that need of a babysitting, because there would be this safe environment that's high trust. And
yeah,
that kind of idea of schools as a form of babysitting, they basically emerged in the 20th century as social cohesion started to break down. I think a lot of it actually in the United States started around the time that immigrants started to arrive in Ellis Island, and the parents were working in factories. So, I mean, that was definitely a factor for early education in the United States.
Right. And as you say, if you were able to create an atmosphere of high trust, it wouldn't be necessary to send the kids to anywhere in particular to make sure that they were safe, as long as you had the necessary prerequisites in place.
And also, it would change how societies or social hierarchies are formed. So there are a lot of intellectual types who might get along better with adults who share their intellectual interests. But the thing about it is, another thing about age segregation is it foments social hierarchies that are based in adolescence and rather than more adult values. So we see this trend in our society where the corporate world and basically our political system is influenced by these adolescent social hierarchies. So if there was less age segregation, there would be social hierarchies would be formed on a different set of values.
Yes, and paradoxically there's also sometimes this, I'm not really sure what to call it, this I guess conformity based pressure that children who are unusual or eccentric in one way or another, who don't fit in so well with most of the other kids, they've got to learn to be with kids their own age, and nobody, I went over this in the post, no one really is able to give a cogent explanation as to why this is, especially since, you know, if they have the faculties that enable them to get along perfectly well with adults, then it's difficult to see what moral problem there is with it.
And then what often happens is a lot of these individuals, they become socially isolated, or they conform to the existing social hierarchy. So I think, yeah, it suppresses a lot of intellectual activities. So basically, I mean, the way education is set up, it does kind of enforce conformity, both the education system and the way socialization ends up working.
Right. That also ties somewhat into the topic of my later post, or my more recent post, which I guess you could say that kids who aren't temperamentally suited to that kind of environment sometimes get vilified. We have this sort of psychiatric bureaucracy of, these convenient diagnoses like oppositional defiant disorder and so on, which these are sort of personality traits that you could say are maladaptive within the current social system, or the currently education as it currently exists. But that doesn't mean that they have to be dysfunctional, or that they would be dysfunctional in every single environment. There just needs to be more choice, basically, in how the education system operates too, and how other social systems operate to accommodate people who have different psychological tendencies.
Yeah, societies are geared towards a certain personality type, so I think it's important that society finds niches for different personality types. And I mean, there are different types of students, so there's the issues with the proletariat where there's like a culture of fighting, but just focusing more on more intelligent students, there's some students who act out just out of boredom, and they find school boring, so that causes them to get into trouble. And then there's just the issue of extreme introverts or extreme introversion, and these are this kind of students that might get diagnosed as having Asperger's, or they just are students who... Some of these students, they have issues with socialization, but there's also a type of personality type where they might be... they're better off maybe specializing on one particular issue. So I think education and the economy should be focused more on a specialization in niches and finding out what everyone is best at. But there is this notion in education that everyone has to be good at everything, but the end result of that is that leads to mediocrity.
Yeah, and I mean, on mediocrity, it's the majority of people, the standard story about education that everyone internalizes is that you're there to learn the material, but the actual evidence shows that most people don't remember very much at all of what they quote-unquote learn. Because there's no, for the majority of people, there's no particular reason that they would. Because they don't have the aptitude. So most people don't retain much beyond basic literacy and numeracy. So then, therefore, for the great majority, I don't think it makes sense to pool huge resources into much beyond that. There should also be, I guess, job-seeking advice, you could call it, although automation could be a confounding factor there, but that notwithstanding. And also psychometric testing that has real value, IQ testing, for instance. There's lots of talk about using that in to improve hiring practice, for instance, instead of just relying on credentialism. Or you could also use some kind of job-specific test. The army actually does this, as far as I know. In most countries, they, or in Britain anyway, there are certain niches that you can fill within the military that don't actually require a credential. They just give you a test, which makes more sense in general, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot more sense. I mean, part of the reason they got rid of IQ testing because it was politically incorrect and anti-egalitarian. But the system of credentialism ended up being a lot more exploitative. I mean, socially exploitative, but also economically exploitative if you look at the system with a massive student loan debt. So, that system would make a lot more sense as long as, I mean, combined with a meritocracy, so you can work and improve your... You can obviously educate yourself, but I think IQ testing or just some kind of a psychological test, I mean, that definitely is something that has to be looked into because the current system of credentialism is not working. I mean, you make another excellent point in this article, is you say that geniuses tend to be self-taught.
Indeed. Well, most geniuses, this just comes from experience of observing people with those psychological attributes. Which is that they tend to find school incredibly boring because it isn't really geared towards exceptional people, either on the right tail of the bell curve or the left tail. People who are on the far left tail don't get much out of it because, well, they don't have the aptitude to get anything out of it, so they just kind of plod through it miserably and at the end have very little to show for it in terms of signaling currency, i.e. the grades, the credentials, whereas the hyper-intelligent people tend to just find the entire thing really innocuous and crushing and soul-destroying.
Yeah, so basically the people who tend to thrive the most in education are more the kind of a mediocre or average people. So the geniuses or people that we talk about addressing the needs of the intelligent, and that's not being addressed as far as people who are, I mean, not cut out for education or less intelligent. Basically, for them, part of it's an issue of babysitting because parents and the government don't want disruptive teenagers from the lower classes out in the streets causing problems. So I mean, that's a big part of it. I think for them, learning some kind of a trade school, learning like a trade, that would actually make a lot more sense. I mean, part of the problem is there was this notion based on egalitarian ideas that everyone has to go to college and get a white-collar job, but it's actually made it a lot worse for those people because a lot of them have actually, a lot of times, like, those people have completely failed and they've ended up much worse off. So, in the short term, I think learning a skill like becoming a plumber might be a better career path. But I also think in the long term, automation will eliminate a lot of lower end jobs. So I mean, that's a whole other issue we'll have to deal with. But the key point is there needs to be this specialization, and it is kind of, I mean, there is some kind of irony that this whole idea of egalitarianism, that the same thing works for everyone's the same, has actually exacerbated income inequality and social inequality.
Yeah, it ironically helps no one. Yeah.
Yeah, basically, very few people. I mean, some people, I guess some people manage, but it's had a pretty bad effect. You mentioned virtual education. I do think there are a lot of benefits to virtual education, but the only potential downside is that it could lead to more social isolation.
Yeah. Well, with respect to brick-and-mortar universities, as most people understand them today, it's debatable whether or not the world actually needs a kind of institutionalized academic elite anymore, with the proliferation of the internet and the equal availability of huge amounts of information to basically everyone in the entire world, which I'm all for, of course. I think it's a fantastic thing. So you could imagine universities being outcompeted to some extent in the fullness of time by massive online courses, or maybe even VR, which that'll be interesting to watch unfold. But mind you, I'm not saying that the old way of doing university, or the standard way, I guess, will or should completely disappear. It's just that in a market sense, you could see it becoming less dominant, because I don't think virtual education is for everyone, just that university as we know it now might use its cultural dominance. Because media consumption, the way that people interact with computer devices, with their phones, or whatever else, is as heritable as anything else is, which is why, for instance, I didn't even own a mobile phone until this week, whereas my brothers have both had theirs for years, despite the fact that I'm actually younger than either of them are by quite a number of years, so that's one of the reasons I'm not too bothered about this dystopian concern that the species will go extinct as we, you know, disappear up our own fundament via virtual reality or whatever it might be, because there'll always be some people who lack the interest. But on social isolation, I think that's an interesting concern. It's possible, though, that eventually virtual reality could actually enhance or maybe complement real-world social interaction as it becomes hyper-realistic, because you could interact with someone, say, on the other side of the world as if in person by just interacting with them through virtual avatars. Sort of like the methods of communication online that people have now, but with a visual interface, which will make you feel like you're interacting with a real person very vividly. And that'll be interesting.
Do you want to talk about your article on psychopaths?
Yeah, well, that ties in to a certain degree to the theme of education, because I was trying to tap into a sense that modern psychiatrists and clinicians and what you might call the psychiatric bureaucracy, it pathologizes psychological attributes which are, if not normal, then often harmless. And there's strains of those traits which can be harmful or pathological, but they're features as opposed to bugs, which is to say that they're maladaptive in the context in which they currently exist, but they're obviously adaptive in some other environment, some past environment, or what have you. And this post applied that reasoning specifically to psychopathy, or dark triad traits, as they're called, narcissism, Machiavellianism, and so on, but just because those topics are sensationalized more than others. Another problem is that we use these kinds of discrete categories like sociopath or narcissist when it's all on a continuous distribution. I think basically everyone on the planet has at least some of these traits. It's just a matter of degree, and the psychiatry as it exists now sort of cordons off the most extreme end, I guess, of the distribution in a somewhat arbitrary way and says that this just isn't normal. And, yeah, but you could also apply the same reasoning to such things as Asperger's syndrome, because there are plenty of people with those traits who manage to lead perfectly functional lives. And there are people with psychopathic traits who are also fine, who are basically normal, functional people. Like the woman mentioned in that article that I retweeted, I think, recently, My Life as a Psychopath was interesting.
Back to what I was saying about social cohesion, I think in a society with more social cohesion, different, where people are collaborating, then there can be more room for different personality traits, with each one would have its own economic niche. I think radical individualism is what leads to this idea that everyone has to be good at everything, which leads to mediocrity.
Yeah, I would agree.
What's interesting is we were talking about self-contained cities and the education system, and also kind of the way high schools and colleges are set up. So with high schools are very closed in. I mean, it's a form of babysitting, but I remember being in a big public high school, and it's almost a kind of more of a like a prison type environment. But with colleges are different. So I mean, there are a lot of criticisms you can say about the way that colleges are set up as far as education, but what I find fascinating from an urbanist angle is basically colleges are the only aspect of urbanism in our society that do have some attributes of a self-contained city. So, I mean, basically, I mean, a lot of major universities, you have about 20,000 students in a relatively compact area. There's communal spaces for both recreation, for shopping. A lot of them have excellent botanical gardens and park spaces. And, I mean, a major thing about colleges is that they're also walkable, so they're able to function without cars. So parking is usually on the street level, but it's a pretty large area that's able to function without cars. So I think there is stuff that can be learned from university campuses in setting up self-contained cities.
Yeah, or even, as we've discussed before, individual buildings. Like, there's this current example of a place in Alaska, the town, I think it's called Whittier in Alaska. I talked to Pilita about it one time. It's essentially an autonomous community, basically, but they all live in one building, isolated in the Alaskan wilderness. It's fascinating. And technological advancement could allow you to expand on that concept somewhat more. You could maybe imagine that paradigm for dealing with communities could prevail, maybe as a way of dealing with population density. There are already East Asian countries and Russia as well, I think, who were experimenting with this, talking about building arcologies and so on.
Oh yeah, arcology is the model where you have one city in one entire structure. So, I mean, that's one model. Or you could just have a series of structures that are interconnected.
Yeah.
And with structuring education in a more self-contained city, then, as I said, education can focus more on the practical aspects. Education itself, job apprenticeships. But because there will be more, it will be a kind of a safe communal environment. There will no longer be a need for kind of schools as basically glorified babysitting, or using schools almost, as I said, almost like kind of like prisons as well. So students, and also I think it's a huge waste of time, because I mean, your time is precious, and I just think about all the hours that I wasted where I was not happy. But at the same time, I wasn't doing something productive either. So any more self-contained city, and also there's this notion in education that you need to put in as many hours as possible, but I think that's nonsense. I think you can accomplish a lot in, say, just about 5 hours. So I remember school, I would spend a lot of time just waiting around staring at the clock. Then I would come home, and a lot of my personal time at home was taken up by doing homework. So using time more efficiently, and then basically the time that you have free should go to basically leisure and doing something that you want to do. And in a more communal self-contained city model, the time that there will be the time that's not the recreation time or leisure time that's not being utilized will be spent a lot more productively. So just, it's more efficient from an education standpoint, but it would just create a more high-trust society with an overall quality of life.
Yeah, and it's incredible. I mean, the evidence, people just accept it as a given, but the evidence that putting in these kinds of crazy hours will help you learn is just, well, obviously it's just not there. It's even worse to a certain extent in East Asian cultures, which is interesting. You hear these stories about children essentially having to work 16-hour days, rote memorizing things and so on.
And I also think for the most intelligent people especially, they can accomplish a lot. Like if you think about the greatest innovators, they can come up with the best ideas. They can learn a lot in a relatively short period of time. I don't think this idea of like long hours is for the advancement of society. I think a lot of it is conditioning, because corporations want people to work as long hours as possible so they can exploit them and depress wages. But I don't have the evidence to back that up as far as educational system. But I will say that you can have a productive society and also have more of a culture of leisure where a lot can be done for both education and careers in a shorter period of time with more leisure time and still have a productive economy.
Well, one of the purported reasons you said you weren't sure if there's evidence of education feeding into that problem that you just alluded to is that the hypothesis, or one of the hypotheses I've seen for how the system of credentialism, as we now know it, came about, is that it's essentially training people to be good worker drones. You know, they set you lots of boring assignments in education, and that, as I say, proving people up to see whether or not they'll be good in the, whether or not they'll be effective worker drones in the corporate world and conformist, etc.
And also with automation, there will be less demand for people overall as workers, but there will be more demand for higher skilled workers, especially in fields of technology.
Right. Even when automation completely subsumes human beings in their abilities, which will be an interesting sort of transition sociologically, there are all kinds of interesting debates about how society should be rearranged to accommodate this change. You mentioned more of a society of leisure, and we already have some examples of what that might look like on a smaller scale. Like in European history, the British aristocracy, it was considered kind of demeaning to have to sell your talents or whatever for money. So instead, they spent more of their time at leisure. Doesn't really seem the right way to say it, because of course some of them were doing interesting things. And a re-engineering of society away from making money, more towards having fun or being creative, as they say, etc.
Yeah, I mean, that should be the goal of society. And our current economic model is it's primarily about trying to get as much, yeah, basically is to create worker drones. I mean, one thing that is interesting about concern about basically dysgenics, where the most well-educated people are not having the most kids. But I do think that in a more self-contained city environment, where there's less need for constant parental supervision, that would also address a lot of those issues as well.
Yes, I think so too.
You would say that on the whole debate between natalism and antinatalism, you're basically neutral, but you're not, at the same time, you're not an antinatalist, but you're not one of those people who is overtly hysterical about overpopulation.
Yes, I'm not really an overpopulation person, because I'm quite confident that given certain advances in technology, we could find ways to increase the carrying capacity of the Earth. The salient question is more like who's reproducing. As you say, dysgenics, that's an interesting concern. But even the projections that I've seen, there's an interesting paper somewhere about predicted increases in population if, say, we completely stopped aging from technology, assuming that birth rates remain fairly steady, which is quite low now in most industrialized nations. And the actual increase in population over time is quite slow, nothing to be too hysterical about, I shouldn't think.
And you pointed out something interesting, that the study that showed there's a U-shaped relationship between income and fertility. I've actually kind of noticed that trend firsthand just based on observations, but that's not something that gets discussed about. I think the common narrative that you hear from HBD bloggers is more about the whole sort of like the idiocracy theory, but that's actually not entirely accurate. What we have now is a U-shape infertility, so the birth rates are plummeting the most among middle-income people.
Yes, that's true, and there are interesting questions about, well, the hypothesis about why it would be that rich women are having more children is because they have more financial security. The question is whether it's possible to attain that or attain the same effect without turning everyone into a millionaire or just engineering a situation where everyone suddenly has huge amounts of money. And a priori, I don't see any reason to think that you couldn't have that sense of security with some new social innovations, with, like, say, for instance, a basic income. And we also know that there's a relationship between housing prices, high housing prices and low fertility, and also population density, which is something that I don't think I've talked about before. People in highly population-dense areas tend to have fewer children. So, yeah.
Yeah, housing is a huge part of it. You did mention some things proposed by Greg Johnson, such as limiting the number of properties a person is allowed to own and reduce speculative bubbles. I think he did propose that, but that must have been on one of the really older shows I did with him. It may have been the one on the Boomerang Generation, I forget, or one of the economic shows. I do think a lot of people think population density is inherently bad or unlivable, but it all depends on how you structure it. So the way population density is now is not necessarily viable. Even places like Hong Kong and Tokyo, which are very extremely futuristic, they definitely have their flaws. But I think a higher population density in an urban area could work, but you have to structure it the right way. So there has to be a lot of public space, both parklands and access to wilderness. But you also need a lot of urban recreational areas and communal areas, basically like an urban oasis. So this could also be indoors as well. And that ties into the theme of like a self-contained city, where kind of a safe area where middle class or upper middle class people can raise families. And then another issue is just the housing size. So in a lot of these dense urban areas, they're full. Either you have apartment or condo units that are either ultra expensive, or you just have tons of small one bedroom or studio apartments. So if you create incentives for real estate developers to build lots of 3 and 4 bedroom units that are accessible to more middle income people, that will definitely have an effect. But there has to be incentives for that.
Well, yeah, I think also that housing is an interesting aspect to it, and housing prices in Britain, for instance, are even in the less expensive areas, it's something like 10 times the average household income, which obviously is somewhat unpragmatic for raising families. So those specific solutions, I don't know in the long run how successful they might prove, but yeah, it'll be interesting to try many different possible solutions. Yeah,
with these self-contained cities, I think they can either be futuristic or they can be inspired by the aesthetics of more like a more modern or retro take on the traditional village model. I notice with Brandon Adamson, he seems to dislike both skyscrapers and vertical living, but he's also not a big fan of villages and wilderness. I mean, I'm not really critiquing him. I think it's fine that different people have different tastes. His aesthetic preference seems to be more, I guess his ideal of a self-contained city is a sort of 70s type mall that would be like the film Logan's Run. I definitely like that aesthetic. So, I'm not criticizing him. People just have different tastes, but I personally really like both a kind of a retro-futuristic city that would have lots of skyscrapers, maybe connected by sky bridges, but I also like the idea of creating a more self-contained city that can be influenced by the more traditional village model, on maybe kind of a very compact, with say about 20,000 people, but inspired by the model of a more traditional or a medieval European city, and then it could exist in an area with surrounded by wilderness. So, I definitely have really eclectic taste, and I'm really interested in variety.
Yeah, I am as well, and I think we've discussed this before. You could envision a situation where you had zoning of some kind in a city, a large city based on aesthetics, different zones with different, for people of different aesthetic preferences.
Yeah, kind of almost like building a city based on a theme park like Disneyland.
Yeah.
That's interesting because that's something that's implemented in theme parks, but it's not actually being put out as a vision as how people can live. And I think there's a lot of ways to restructure society to create a more livability. And a lot of people are debating political issues, just the back and forth, but I think it's important, yeah, to put out a clear vision to just improve the overall quality of life. And there are these tensions between different groups with competing interest, but obviously not everyone's going to be happy. There's always going to be winners and losers within a society. But I also think that having a kind of niche-based economy and then a variety of aesthetics, there is a way to cater to a lot of different groups. And I kind of like what Brandon Adamson said once in a show. He quoted someone, actually I think it might have been Pappy Cannon, who said, true freedom is not just doing whatever you want, but being able to live in the kind of society that you want. And I also think that, it is inevitable to some degree that Western societies are going to become more diverse, but with the kind of a self-contained city model, it will provide an opportunity for each group of people to basically live in the kind of community that they want, whether it's and then also I think the kind of creating a utopian aesthetic of your ideal aesthetic vision, but also creating cohesive communities where people have shared values and there's high levels of social trust. So basically using futurist solutions to address a concern, to address a lot of traditionalist concerns.
Yeah, and you could have kind of a healthy separatism. Yes, I would agree.
Is there anything else you'd like to add about the theme of education?
No, I think we about covered everything.
I guess one more thing I'll add is education is important to address because it affects every single sector of our society, because it affects the culture, it affects the economy. So if education is restructured, I think it will have the kind of effect of restructuring how our society works.
Oh yeah, and it's also worth saying on different types of people as well, and people being disadvantaged and so on. I do think that even sort of talentless, mediocre people deserve a good life, which is why it's part of the reason that the basic income is something that I'm interested in.
Ashley Messinger, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thanks.